Illinois Wesleyan University is sending forth this year's graduates into the world on Sunday in a time of great opportunity and great fear. Seeking to advise them in the graduation speech is 1980 Illinois Wesleyan graduate Dr. Stephen Andra. Andra has been a surgeon, soldier, teacher, administrator, and insurance executive, a device maker, a researcher, a healthcare policy expert, that last one in the Obama administration. He's now a consultant. He speaks with healthcare policy about healthcare policy with Charlie Schlenker via Zoom. But first, Andra talked about his speech, saying the message is not different than one, two, or three decades ago. It's the importance of a liberal arts education. But Andra says it's even more important today.
This is the generation that's graduating in the shadow of the recession of 2008, 2009. And that made people really think about college and education differently and had people much more focused on the endpoint of what kind of job are you going to get, rather than the simple act of becoming educated and learning how to learn. That's logical, but it's actually contrary to where the world is moving. You know, when you look at the doubling of knowledge, at the end of World War II, knowledge was doubling every 25 years. Today it's doubling about once a year. And in the lifetime of these graduates, it'll be once a day. And when you start to think about that, how artificial intelligence and other changes in the way knowledge is accumulated are going to transform society, I think professionals, which is where many college graduates are headed, are going to have the same kind of fundamental changes in their work lives that industrial workers had with the advent of automation and robotics. And so that ability to reinvent yourself, to continue to learn, to see the world in a larger way, especially as the world gets smaller, it makes a liberal arts education not a good thing or a nice thing, but an essential thing to success.
And yet people do respond to more immediate stresses and pressures. There's some research that indicates that people who come of age during a recession are more risk averse than those who come of age in a time of large economic growth, that their careers develop more slowly and their top earning potential is less because they don't leap for a new position. You were arguing for boldness?
Yes. You know, I think not only for boldness, but for, I think that risk aversion in a time of change is something that puts you at risk for being passed by. There's a great quote from General Hugh Shelton, who may have picked it up from somewhere else, but this is where I got it. He was chairman of the Joint Chiefs in the 90s. His quote was, "The game favors the bold." And in times of change, hanging on to the past, grabbing onto something that's static, is a way to get left behind.
Let's move to your area of expertise, healthcare and technology. How rapidly is technology continuing to shift not only healthcare, but the administration of healthcare, where one out of every $4 get spent on healthcare in this nation?
Yeah, you know, we're talking about change, and healthcare is undergoing fundamental change, will continue to. So in the technology space, I think artificial intelligence will change the way patients receive care, how physicians, nurses, and other providers of care deliver it in very fundamental ways, and how it's administered. Information is power. And when you take a look at the amount of information that is data that is available, and how artificial intelligence will change the way that data is converted into information, and how that information will change the very nature of practice. You know, we're on a video chat, at least on my end right now. It's hard to imagine that this won't become a much more convenient way to deliver a lot of care. And I'll give you a real example. I was at a meeting and got an eye infection. And I was able to take a picture of my eye, send it to my doctor, along with where a local drugstore was in the middle of North Carolina. And within less than a half an hour, I had the eye drops in my eye to take care of it. That was efficient. It met everyone's needs. And it was much cheaper because my only other alternative would have been to go to urgent care or an emergency room. That is just one little example of how technology is going to change fundamentally how healthcare is delivered. It will also empower us to transition to shared risk arrangements and value-based reimbursement models. But to succeed in that, everybody's going to have information to understand how to manage risk and how to reward a higher value.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Dr. Stephen Andra, formerly of President Obama's administration, a health technology advisor, and a healthcare consultant in the technology area. He's also the Illinois Wesleyan University commencement speaker this year. What does a new system look like if you have artificial intelligence is handling or backing up a real doctor in routine diagnostic cases, if you have channels set for lower level ailments to lessen the cost? Who's the traffic cop? How do you decide which way to go, whether it's a video chat with a diagnostician or when somebody really needs to see somebody?
Right now, the traffic cop is the insurer, the payer, and that's for the simple reason they're the only ones who have responsibility for the cost of care for the population. Doctors and nurses have a responsibility to the individual patient in front of them, but they don't really have responsibility, at least a direct responsibility, for the overall care of cost in the population. And because of that, efficiency of outcome is not an aligned incentive. That leaves it with the payer, who's responsible for not only making sure they cover individuals, but that they do it in a way for the population that it is affordable for everyone. So premiums don't get even worse than they already are. When you start to share risk in value-based reimbursement models, then both provider and payer have skin in the game in terms of not only the outcome for that individual, but the efficiency of the outcome, the overall cost. And so that puts it actually the regulation, not resting solely with the insurer, but with the doctor also. And that's really where you want the regulation to occur, is at the doctor and patient level. And so value-based reimbursement will move those decisions of regulation, what's delivered, how it's delivered, away from the insurer and towards the doctor and patient, where it is much more efficiently done. And efficiency, in part because, you know, when I was at Blue Cross, you know, we knew what was the right thing to do for a population and for most individuals in that population, and could regulate that appropriately. But I may not know you as an individual. The person that knows you as an individual is you and your doctor. And you and your doctor will understand the nuances that may not match you up with the average of the population and can make better decisions. The insurer just doesn't have that ability, but they're the only ones, they're holding all the risk to control the cost for the population. So moving that downstream to shared risk, I think, will help people make better and more rational decisions and put regulation where it will be more effectively done.
As you say, we're starting to see those models develop. Doctors in Bloomington Normal are beginning to get incentives for directing patients into wellness or lower level ongoing care rather than critical care or high intervention care. What might a fully mature model of that look like?
A fully mature model will have a variety of reimbursement models for the diverse healthcare sector. the idea of population health works very well in the realistic implementation in primary care. Things such as bundled payment for care improvement initiatives work very well in specialty care. And so I think you're going to see, and medical homes for high-risk populations, unique high-risk populations can be effective. And so I think you're seeing an exploration of a small portfolio of value-related reimbursement options emerging that will get refined, and then it will be piecing them together. And how they're pieced together may be slightly differently in different areas of the country. Let's just take Illinois. Bloomington Normal is very different than Metro Chicago, and that is very different than rural downstate Illinois. The idea that you will have a one-size-fits-all for all three of those communities is a little naive. One-size-fits-all probably fits one, but it won't fit the other two. And so what you want is some flexibility and a set of components, in a sense, that you assemble in a way that makes sense for the community that it is going into, the culture, the organization, the way the healthcare is delivered in those communities. And so you need a little bit of flexibility and implementation with a commonality of goal. And the goal is improving healthcare value, which, you know, Michael Porter defined as quality over cost. And that's the goal. How you get to that goal should have some flexibility. It is going to be understanding the rational self-interest of all involved, harnessing and aligning that to the outcome that we want for a health system, which is going to be a more accessible, more equitable, higher value, and economically sustainable system.
Does the political discourse, either on the progressive side, talking about Medicare for all, or on the conservative side, accurately reflect the what you're talking about, this realignment?
Yeah, so it's interesting. You know, when you look at the shift to value, you see support from both sides. And here's a great example of that. The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation was created as part of the Affordable Care Act to promote the transition from volume-driven fee-for-service to value-driven reimbursement models. And it catalyzed that activity. And that was under the Obama administration. It has continued under the Trump administration. And in fact, you've seen some very creative things coming out from Secretary Azar and the Administrator Seema Verma. And just in the last week or two, there's a really innovative model in primary care, essentially capitating payments for primary care to help drive this. So you're seeing a push towards this simply because there's not another option to control cost. And from both sides of the political aisle, where the discourse comes in is, while there's general agreement of what we want, how to get there has some disagreement. And part of that is we're fighting out, we're using the healthcare as a surrogate for some of the oldest fights we've had in this country, fights around states' rights versus federal authority, how much government involvement do we want in our system. And so you see a lot of political discourse spill over into an area that there is agreement on what we want to get to and disagreement on how to get there.
Well, those fights aren't going to go away. Are they going to stop the progress, do you think?
No. Okay. They're going to get in the way like speed on a highway. And so, yeah, and if you're the healthcare system driving your car, you're going to, you know, it's going to be a really bumpy and a little bit terrifying road. It's going to be hard to plan and strategize, but the road is pretty clear. And so it's going to be a bumpy road, and the politics will make it bumpier than it needs to be. But that's democracy. And I always say that, you know, democracy implements good ideas in a very erratic, slow, inefficient fashion. It also moves really bad ideas forward slowly and inefficiently. and so the double-edged sword of the inefficiency of how we govern the republic means that we don't move in good directions as fast as we would like, but it keeps us from moving in bad directions faster than we should.
Dr. Stephen Andra, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Illinois Wesleyan's commencement ceremony will take place at 1 p.m. Sunday. This is Sound Ideas.